And you're listening to Gerald Horn and Norman Otis Richmond, Dr. Gerald Horn. And first I wanted to ask you, how are you doing today, my good friend?
Fine, and yourself?
Oh, I cannot complain. I guess we wanted to talk a lot about Africa today, situation in the Democratic Republic of Congo, East Africa, Rwanda, Burundi, and so on and so forth. But I guess I wanted to begin by saying that the Congo has been a very underreported story in the corporate press. Now, we know that the Congo began as, in modern times, let's just start with King Leopold's Congo. Then it became the Belgium Congo. Then it became the Congo under the Honorable Patrice Lumumba. And for a moment, it was Zaire under Joseph Mobutu. And today, we know it as the Democratic Republic of Congo. And I would like to ask you, why do you feel that the situation in the Congo, where nearly 6 million human beings have been murdered and women are being raped on a daily basis, why is this cover underreported in the corporate press, and even the progressive press has not really done a lot to deal with the Congo?
Well, first of all, King Leopold's Congo, as you know, beginning of the late 19th century and then the 20th century before 1960, the Belgian Congo, and then approximately 1960, Patrice Lumumba coming to power and then assassinated, not least because of the machinations of the United States Central Intelligence Agency, which leads to a process of turmoil culminating in the rise of the former official in the military, Joseph Mobutu, who becomes a dictator and, of course, chief kleptocrat and one of the world's richest men before dying in North Africa approximately 14 or 15 years ago or more. And then that leads, of course, to the other stage of turmoil culminating in the present regime of Mr. Kabila, the current leader in Kinshasa. Congo is a country that is as large as the United States east of the Mississippi River, yet it hardly has any paved roads. You ask, why is it that it receives so little attention in the corporate press and to a degree even in the progressive press? Well, let me flip that question on its head and ask, why is it, say, countries like Zimbabwe and Sudan receive so much attention? And I think it's because in Zimbabwe you have a European minority that many feel is being repressed, and that inevitably leads to attention in the North Atlantic. And in Sudan you have a country that is perceived to be an Arab country, that seemingly, according to some, is repressing a non-Arab minority, and that plays well amongst those who hold Zionism dear. So I think that helps to shed light, perhaps, on why the Congo doesn't receive sufficient attention, because even though it is a vast and fabulous storehouse of minerals, we all know about coltan, that essential element that goes into mobile phones that are now being produced in the millions, which disproportionately comes from the Congo. Yet, despite its value, despite the fact that some of the elements that went into the atomic bombs that were detonated over Hiroshima and Nagasaki in August 1945 came from the Congo, yet it continues to be allowed to go into turmoil. And that's not to say the international community is not paying attention. Of course, you know that the United Nations has one of its largest peacekeeping missions in the Congo. But that has not stopped a veritable reign of terror, particularly against women, that led to the United Nations passing Resolution 1820, which was one of the first efforts by the international community to target rape as a weapon of war. And that was a very noble gesture on behalf of the United Nations, but sadly, tragically, and unfortunately, that resolution has not necessarily been enforced. In fact, the United Nations peacekeepers, as they are euphemistically called, are now being accused of enabling some of the worst transgressions of the war that is particularly afflicting the Eastern Congo, which shares a border with Rwanda, which we all know had a very terrible genocide about a decade and a half ago, and also the problems in neighboring Uganda are spilling over into Congo. We all know about Mr. Museveni and his reign in Uganda. He's a so-called fair-haired boy, if I'm allowed to use that term, of the North Atlantic powers, and that's one of the reasons why we don't hear so much about the transgressions that he and his military have been committing in Congo, nor have we heard sufficiently about the connection between the problems in the Congo and the problems in the Sudan. So all in all, it's a very terrible situation, and we can only organize and agitate for the major powers to do something to right this wrong. Now, interestingly enough, China has been interested quite a bit in Congo, and indeed helped to engineer a major deal that I discuss in my recent book, Blows Against the Empire, U.S. Imperialism Crisis, where in exchange for access to these minerals, China would be building power plants and roads and universities and hospitals and, quite frankly, installing a modern infrastructure. But the North Atlantic powers, particularly the United States, which has not bestirred itself sufficiently as Congo has spiraled downward, bestirred itself when it saw China getting involved, and all of a sudden we heard all of these scare stories about how China is colonizing Africa. And so some stumbling blocks have been put in the path of this potentially transformative deal, and we can only hope that those stumbling blocks will be removed.
Okay, this is the last question in relationship to the Congo. Could you discuss the role or the legacy of Patrice Lumumba in 2009?
Well, I think the legacy of the great Patrice Lumumba is substantial and large. We all know about his role in the fight for Congolese independence. We all know about the role of the U.S. CIA in terms of his murder. But more than that, we know about his legacy in terms of Patrice Lumumba University, which was set up in Moscow in the former Soviet Union to educate a rising generation of African professional workers and intellectuals, and is still in existence, even though it's fallen somewhat into hard times in light of the demise of the Soviet Union. That's one of his lasting legacies. But I think more than that, it's the philosophy of militancy that Patrice Lumumba bequeathed is probably the most significant part of his legacy. Because of Patrice Lumumba, we see Africans standing taller, not only on the continent, but in the diaspora as a whole.
And I think that we should encourage young people to go out and get a copy of the film Lumumba, which was done by a great Haitian filmmaker, Raoul Peck. I think that I encourage all the younger people and those people that want to know a little bit about the Congo and who may not want to sit down and read a whole book at this time. I'm certain if they see this film, that will inspire them to sit down and read a book or two in relationship to the Congo and Mr. Lumumba and Mr. Mobutu and the whole cast of characters in that struggle. I wanted to ask you...
Let me mention another point about the Congo, and this is something that's oftentimes neglected and one of the central reasons why I think we should maintain an interest in the Congo. And that is because, whether we know it or not, a huge percentage of the Africans in the diaspora, particularly in the Americas, have roots in the Congo.
Mm-hmm.
You may recall that during the horrible history of the slave trade, which lasted hundreds of years, there were probably more Africans brought after 1808 from Africa to the Americas. 1808, of course, being when we were told that Britain and the United States moved to abolish the slave trade. But after it was abolished, there were probably more Africans brought. And of those Africans who were brought to the Americas, a huge percentage came precisely from the Congo. And so we have all these Congolese Americans walking around in the Western Hemisphere who may be unaware of their actual roots, and I think that rekindling an interest in the Congo is a way, quite frankly, for people to rekindle an interest in their own history. I should also mention this. We're talking about the DRC, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, this huge sprawling country with its capital in Kinshasa. But there's also a Congo-Brazzaville. It was formerly called the People's Republic of the Congo, now the Republic of the Congo. It was like the DRC was a former Belgian colony. This is a former French colony. And like many African nations during the Cold War period, it sought assiduously to build a form of socialism. And that was objected to vigorously by the North Atlantic powers to the point of destabilization. They basically said, no, you're not allowed to build socialism. You can only allow a system. You can only have a system where there's capitalism and a few wealthy and many, many poor. And so the People's Republic of the Congo was forced to disassemble its socialist project. And now elections are coming up, quite frankly, very soon, on July 12, 2009. And there's a lot of rumbling and tension in the country because, of course, of the immense inequalities in that nation. And it would not surprise me at all if there was some sort of volcanic explosion in the Republic of the Congo, in Congo Brazzaville, either in the run-up to these elections in July 2009 or shortly thereafter.
Let me say one last thing about the Congo-Brazzaville. I remember at one time Congo-Brazzaville actually had a stamp with John William Coltrane's photograph on it. I never will forget that. They were socialists and fierce Pan-Africanists as well. I mean, they embraced the Africans in the diaspora pretty much.
Well, you should know that during the battle days of colonialism, that Congo Brazzaville in some ways was the administrative center for French colonialism in the region, in a way not dissimilar to the role Dakar, Senegal played. And as a partial result of that administrative role, Congo Brazzaville basically developed a rather sophisticated core and cadre of intellectuals and political activists. It's no accident that it was a symbol of socialism in Africa in the 1970s and 1980s. And it still retains some of that spirit despite the battering that it's taken from the North Atlantic powers in recent years.
Now let's move to Rwanda. Now some people are holding up Rwanda as a beacon of progress, so on and so forth. But I wanted to get your take on what is the demographic between Tutsis and Hutus today? How are Hutus treated in terms of discrimination, access to resources, holding leadership positions? And what is the position of Paul Kagame on his former general who devastated the Congo? And in your judgment, who shot down the president? And where is the investigation today? These questions have come from our listeners, so I'm trying to get as many of them in as I can.
Well, as you well know, the country we now know as Rwanda was once a Belgian colony, and because of Belgium's attempt to execute a divide-and-rule strategy, they basically tried to ossify certain distinctions between and amongst peoples we now refer to as Tutsis and Hutus. This set the stage for not only the April 1994 genocide that disproportionately impacted the Tutsi minority, but even leading up to that April 1994 genocide, for beginning, let us say, arbitrarily in the 1950s going forward, you had a number of volcanic explosions in that small Central African nation. Right before the April 1994 genocide was launched, the president of Rwanda's plane was shot down, and as you suggested in your question, it's still unknown. It's still unclear, I should say, who shot down the plane. Now, of course, there have been a number of rumblings about how the French, whose role in Africa, quite frankly, is rather Dracula-like in terms of its draining the blood of the continent. And I might add parenthetically that historians of the future will be shocked, no doubt, when they look back at the record of what the African and African-American and African-Canadian intellectuals were saying in the past few decades, and they will look long and hard for any sort of systematic critique of French policy and French imperialism in Africa, although a fair case could be made for the proposition that the French elites have been the major stumbling block to true African independence. In any case, with the plane being shot down, this was the signal for the attack on what basically amounted to genocide against the Tutsi minority. And then, of course, this led to the forces led by Paul Kagame invading the country and helping to overthrow the genocidaires, as they were called. Strikingly enough, the United States in particular, which is a permanent member of the United Nations Security Council, basically sat on its hands when this genocide was unfolding, despite the fact that Romeo Dallaire of Quebec, Canada, who was a UN military official in Rwanda at that time, as reflected in the memoir that he wrote about this period and also in the rather gripping documentary film Shake Hands with the Devil, was clamoring and calling for international intervention, which did not arise. The long and the short of it is that Paul Kagame was able to come to power. Paul Kagame, who is the present leader of Rwanda, still has very hostile relations with France in particular, and as a partial result of that, has snuggled up to Washington. Indeed, part of the problem in Central Africa right now is this contest between Paris and Washington that's basically playing out on the backs of many Africans. It has been alleged that Mr. Kagame has executed a policy that tends towards discrimination against the Hutus. That has been alleged. It is true that in eastern Congo, there are still forces from the genocidal period of April 1994 who are engaged in attacks repeatedly on Rwandans and Rwandese, not to mention on Congolese, and that is a festering sore in the heart of Africa, and it is a boil that must be lanced at some point. Strikingly, if you consult the press in the North Atlantic community, you will see that Rwanda gets quite a favorable press right now, interestingly enough. It is being touted as something of a leader in terms of telecommunications, in terms of internet penetration, in terms of mobile phone penetration. It is fair to say that the United States in particular has taken a keen interest in Rwanda, and that has opened the door to an infusion of capital, not to mention an infusion of healthcare services, which is keeping the population much healthier than its neighbor, for example, in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. I should also mention that not least because of the genocide, Rwanda has one of the highest rates of female parliamentarians in the world today. And that is something that I think that other African nations should look to with envy and certainly should seek to emulate.
Now, let me ask you, I'm speaking with Dr. Gerald Horn, who is the author of many, many, many books, and this is what we call the Horn Report. Now, we wanted to stay on, we wanted to go to the Sudan. And I wanted to ask you a question which is related to the Sudan and Rwanda. The Zionists have a serious problem with the current leader of the Sudan, and many people feel that the Zionists have a positive relationship with Paul Kagame, President Kagame. Is that the case? And could you talk about the Sudan and its relationship to the attack by the West and the Zionists in particular?
The Sudan is the largest nation by territory on the continent of Africa. Despite the idea that many hold that Ghana led the way in terms of independence for African nations in 1957, of course, Sudan preceded Ghana in terms of independence. And of course, if you wanted to be technical about it, you can see Egypt preceding them all. In any case, Sudan has two major problems, at least. One is the problem in southern Sudan, which has a form of autonomy and which may vote within the next 24 months to secede from Sudan and form its own independent state, which would be quite a blow to Sudan, not least because of the fact that apparently there are some petroleum deposits and other kinds of mineral deposits that have been detected in that part of Africa. The other problem, of course, is Darfur in western Sudan, bordering on Chad. You know that there have been allegations that genocide is unfolding in Sudan, although that is not the position that has been taken by the international community in large part. That kind of allegation, however, led to an indictment by the International Criminal Court of the leadership in Khartoum, Sudan. But this indictment, quite frankly, has been rejected by the Arab League and rejected by a good deal of the African Union, because I think that those two important bodies are beginning to suspect that the International Criminal Court has a fascination, if not obsession, with bringing African leaders to justice, but tends to look the other way with regard to, for example, the criminal and illegal invasion and occupation of Iraq by the Bush-Blair team, for example. Then, of course, there are the personal transgressions of the chief prosecutor, Luis Moreno Ocampo, who has been facing charges of his own with regard to sexual harassment, and that, quite frankly, is a euphemism for the kinds of aggressive molestations with which he has been charged. So this has led to a standoff between African nations on the one hand and the International Criminal Court on the other, and it's unclear what's going to happen as a result. Now, with regard to Mr. Kagame, because of his very close relationship with Washington, everyone knows that it's Washington that helps to keep Israel afloat, and there's always a suspicion that if a leader is close to Washington, that immediately and automatically means that leader is close to Israel. I will not rebut that allegation, that assertion, with regard to Rwanda. Let's just leave it as that.
Okay, now let us move to Somalia, Eritrea, Ethiopia, and that region. I guess we could also say that these areas have been underreported as well. And how would you answer that question in terms, do you think it's because they don't have a white minority as well?
Well, I don't think Somalia has been underreported, not least because of the question of piracy has grabbed international
but that's their fault, though. That's because when I say that's their fault, the West is saying because they are the pirates, so they are concerned about their booty. So they report it for that reason, don't you think?
Yes, in part. And certainly Somalia is a tragedy. I recall being in Ghana some many, many years ago and watching a documentary about Somalia when it was leaning towards the then socialist camp. It was a quite impressive documentary. I mean, the people were very organized. Historically, the Somali people have been seen as being militants. In my book that will be out in a few weeks on Kenya, the liberation struggle in Kenya, I have a number of quotations in there from the British colonialists who are quite frankly saying that they're afraid and petrified of the Somalis because they're such fierce fighters and so militant. And so it doesn't surprise me that after the downfall of the Siad Barre regime in Somalia, after he is enticed to move away from the socialist camp into the imperialist camp on the basis that he will be able to take land from Ethiopia then under the so-called Derg, which was also part of the socialist camp, and Siad Barre snapped at the bait. He moved into the imperialist camp, and that was the beginning of the downfall of Somalia, to the point where you have a breakaway Somaliland regime in northern Somalia. Somalia, if you can envision it on the map of Africa, it's on the Horn of Africa, and it's shaped roughly like the number 7. And so if you look at the top of the number 7, you can imagine and envision this breakaway land of Somaliland, which is broken away from the rest of the nation, which is headquartered in Mogadishu, the capital. Now, we know that not least because of pressure from the imperialist powers, principally of the United States, the Ethiopian forces were enticed to come into Somalia to try to chase out and basically tame those we routinely refer to, perhaps inadequately, as so-called Islamic fundamentalists. That mission by the Ethiopians has been a grand failure, and quite frankly, the Ethiopians are now looking for a way out. Indeed, moving to Ethiopia, this nation in Eastern Africa that has been so dear to the Pan-African imagination over decades, if not centuries, the present leader of Ethiopia, Meles Zenawi, who, interestingly enough, even though he's been in power almost two decades, it's only in his mid-50s, is now making noises about stepping down from power. But he may be making these noises about stepping down from power, quite frankly, because there is a brewing insurrection that's taking place in his country, not least in the Ogaden region of Ethiopia, but also amongst the Oromo people of Ethiopia, who constitute a substantial percentage of that population, even though, of course, routinely in Addis Ababa, the capital, and routinely in the ruling elite of Ethiopia, there's an Amharic superiority or Amharic domination, if you like, in this very important country that has a contemporary population of about 75 million, which makes it one of the largest countries on the African continent. Now, its neighbor, Eritrea, broke away from Ethiopia in the last few decades and has turned into something of a African Sparta, that is to say, Eritrea, which only has a population of 2 or 3 million, is routinely involved in scrapes and fracases with its larger neighbor, Ethiopia. That remains the case. Indeed, it has been suggested that part of the turmoil in Somalia is due to the fact that the Eritreans are supporting the forces who are fighting the Ethiopians, who they see as their eternal foe. There has been a lot of complaint, quite frankly, about the Eritrean leadership, about how they disappointed those who supported them. And I have to say that I think that many of those complaints are well-founded.
And I guess we're going to have to wrap up. We have a couple of minutes. Is there anything else you would like to say in relationship to this part of the interview?
Well, as noted, Zimbabwe, in terms of African coverage, receives a disproportionate amount of attention in the North Atlantic press, despite the fact that, for example, just to cite a few examples, in Guinea-Bissau in recent months, you've seen the physical liquidation of a significant percentage of the political leadership. In recent months, you've seen a military takeover in Guinea-Conakry. In Mali, as we speak, you have the president seeking to engineer a constitutional coup that's leading to a threat of sanctions being imposed upon Mali by the ECOWAS states, that is to say, the Economic Community of West African States, that includes Ghana. Yet these kinds of events are routinely are ignored in the North Atlantic press for whatever reason, leading many in the North American region to routinely feel and suspect that the only human rights violations that are taking place in Africa are taking place in Zimbabwe. I mean, it's quite astonishing if you think about it for more than 30 seconds.
Yes, and look out for Dr. Gerald Horn's new book, Mau Mau in Harlem, and it will be out in a couple of weeks. And we're going to end this show with some music from Randy Weston. This is a CD, now a CD, it was an album recorded in the early 60s, and we're going to play a track called Uhuru Kwanzaa, which was banned by the South African government in 1964, along with Lena Horne's music, Max Roach's music, and Paul Robeson. The great Paul Robeson had the distinction of having his music banned in 1948, but this was all of this music was banned in South Africa in 1964, and this features the great Brock Peters, and many people are on this CD, including the great Ron Carter, who went on to play with Miles Dewey Davis and is a great figure in his on his own, but this is Uhuru Kwanza.
Uhuru! Freedom! Freedom first. Africa, where the great Congo flows. Where the whole jungle knows a new dawning breaks.
Africa!
A young nation awakes.
Africa!
Uhuru!
Africa!
Uhuru!
Africa!
Africa, ambako jua la angaza sana. Africa, ambako ulimwengu wote kwanza. Africa, kutoka usiku wa jana. Uhuru, upepo wa uhuru. Upepo wa uhuru unavuma. The freedom wind blows. Out of yesterday's night, uhuru.
Freedom!
Uhuru!
Freedom!
Uhuru!
Freedom!